I'm really honored to be asked to give this 19th annual Thomas Merton Lecture during Black History Month. I'm humbled and even intimidated by the eminent roster of previous speakers in this series, all of whom I have learned so much from. Now, as we gather tonight, the health of our Holy Father is quite precarious, and we don't know how much longer he will be with us. I have been deeply moved by all that Pope Francis has said and done in this nearly 12 years of his pontificate, and I've discovered a deep resonance between his hopes and his dreams for a renewed humanity and the insights about God, human nature, and universal fraternity expressed by Thomas Merton. Now, my first opportunity to meet Pope Francis in person came during what is colloquially referred to as baby bishop school. There really is such a thing, and the name is apt because we sat in a lecture hall for hours on end to hear someone reading a text to us in a foreign language. But naturally, the highlight of the course is the opportunity to meet with the Holy Father. In 2015, there were 127 of us newbies. And before the encounter with Pope Francis, we were instructed about protocol. He's not too big on that. And encouraged to be brief in our personal words to the Pope because he would greet us individually. But we wanted to make sure we had time to listen to the talk he has prepared for the whole group. For my part, I'm standing in line, mentally formulating my brief introduction to him in Spanish, so the hope that it would immediately register with him and he could respond. So I got to use my highly practiced speech, my highly condensed speech, but I forgot to give one key piece of information that we were told to give. And so with his characteristic smile, Pope Francis looks at me and says, "De donde eres? Where are you from?" When I said, "Lexington," he responded, "Kentucky," without missing a beat. And that heavily accented pronunciation of the bluegrass state is a soundbite that will forever remain unerased in my mind. I was initially quite pleased to think he knew where Lexington was. But a little more than a week later, I discovered why he had Kentucky on his mind. The next encounter with Pope Francis was shortly thereafter in Washington, D.C., where I was thrilled to be in the house, in the balcony of the U.S. House of Representatives for the first ever address to a joint session of Congress by a pope. And everything about that moment was jubilant and memorable. Congressmen and women acting like little kids, jumping up and down. It was amazing to see the enthusiasm and the joy in that place. And even though a lot of the naive patriotism of my Boy Scout days was long gone, I was surprised by my own emotional reaction to hear the Bishop of Rome say, in English, how pleased he was to be in the land of the free and the home of the brave. In the course of that speech, it became very clear why Kentucky was on his mind just days earlier. Because of the four U.S. public figures that he mentioned in his speech, two of them, Abraham Lincoln and Thomas Merton, were Kentuckians. Lincoln and Merton were accompanied in that talk by Dorothy Day and Martin Luther King Jr., contemporaries of Merton, with whom he had a kindred heart, shared fascinations, and aspirations. What interesting choices this first South American pontiff made to be representations of the best of the U.S. American spirit. And even the two non-Catholics share something of the same spirit of Pope Francis, which has been revealed to the Universal Church over these 12 years. A spirit which is both contemplative, as he is a man of careful discernment and deep prayer, and engaged in prophetic action as he strives to make Christ and his church accessible to and inclusive of all. Todos, todos, todos. Everyone, 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 as he himself emphasizes. Now, I'm probably not the only one tonight praying that this nation remain a land of the free, because there's very good reason to question whether it will continue to be so. And I hope that as a nation, we're brave enough to resist and counteract the threats to that cherished freedom from within. As an admirer of Thomas Merton, but certainly not an expert in his thought and writing, I've always been intrigued by his profound engagement in the struggle for civil rights, in the peace movement, and his connection to other contemporary social justice movements from his hermitage in the woods. And his major pilgrimage, both a physical and spiritual pilgrimage that Merton embarked upon in the last part of his short life, is an attractive feature of a man of faith striving to understand and experience the deeper connections among all of humanity, as well as a journey to know more of himself and how he fits into this greater human mystery. I see Pope Francis as a fellow pilgrim of Merton. Even if a half century separates the major activity of their lives, they are indeed contemporaries on the journey, facing the same issues, the same challenges, in different contexts. As a Franciscan, I've been captivated by this first Jesuit pope in history who adopted the name of the little poor man of Assisi and has been sharing Francis's spirituality of peace and fraternity with all creation, and has even brought it to the center of the life of the church. Pope Francis certainly approaches his namesake with an Ignatian lens and with a Latin American flavor. He is thoroughly Franciscan in his joy, in his simplicity, and in his missionary zeal. In that memorable speech to Congress, the Pope commemorated the 150th anniversary of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, and he used that anniversary to warn his hearers, even then, about the dangers of polarization and the problem of simplistically dividing everyone into the good and the evil. He told the elected officials gathered there, quote, "To imitate the hatred and violence of tyrants and murderers is the best way to take their place. That's something which you as a people reject." Instead, he proposed that the way forward is to be one of peace and justice, hope and healing, with a strong commitment to the common good. He celebrated the way that people of different religious traditions were able to come together and work for a more just and peaceful society in the United States. And he praised Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the 50th anniversary of his march from Selma to Montgomery for not giving up on his dream, even though that dream cost him everything. Pope Francis has frequently spoken and even wrote a book about the importance of dreaming, and he used that reference to the great speech of King as a bridge in his talk to the dreams of migrants and refugees who have been, are, and will be contributing to the building up of this nation. Sharing his own story as part of an immigrant family, he addressed the global situation of people on the move for survival. When the Holy Father addresses poverty and wealth in our nation, he invokes the servant of God, Dorothy Day, whose social activism was inspired by the gospel and the witness of the saints. Her witness affirms the dignity of all people and calls the Christian family to solidarity with the materially poor and marginalized. He mentions the centenary of the birth of Thomas Merton and notes that he was struck by how this man, born during the First World War, was led to become a man of dialogue with the hope of avoiding all war. He highlighted Merton's Cistercian life of prayer and called him, quote, "a thinker who challenged the certitudes of his time and opened new horizons for souls and for the church." I hope that as you hear me mention the highlights of this historic speech to the U.S. Congress, you're already thinking of connections between the themes mentioned here and the ever-expanding world and vision of Thomas Merton. I would suggest that the very values Pope Francis hinted at as he connected them to an American context would be very much in line with Merton's vision as he grew to dream beyond the confines of the institutional church to appreciate the spiritual bonds which draw the whole human family together. Fratelli Tutti is the encyclical that Pope Francis issued in the midst of the global pandemic. He acknowledges that his original plan was to write an encyclical addressed to the various religions of the world, expressing the need for them to come together in the promotion of peace. But it was the experience of the pandemic that led Pope Francis to broaden both the perspective and the content of the encyclical to become a heartfelt plea for global fraternity, upon which he believes the future survival of humanity is dependent. It's the second encyclical penned by Pope Francis to take its name and its heart from the writings of Francis of Assisi. Pope Francis made it a point to sign this encyclical at the tomb of St. Francis on the eve of his feast day in 2021, in a greatly scaled back papal mass celebrated in Assisi under all the constraints of the pandemic and consistent with the very simplicity of the place. The title, which means that all its addressees are brothers and sisters, comes from a letter by Francis of Assisi to the people of his day called to live the gospel. It has significant ties to his previous encyclical mentioned in the Pope's address to Congress, Laudato Si, which took its title from St. Francis' famous poem about the interrelationship of all creation, which by its nature reveals and praises the Creator. In Laudato Si, the emphasis is on creation as a gift for everyone and about the responsibility that the recipients of the gift have to preserve it. It's remarkable as an encyclical for its inclusion of scientific data and the interpretation of that data concerning the rapid destruction of the planet. Encyclicals usually don't have that kind of information. The Pope sees the necessity for a conversion in thinking and a conversion in acting about our relationship with all living and all created things. The encyclical looks at the relations of human beings within their environment and also within the human family itself. Noting that, as always, the poor pay a greater share of the cost of economic development while reaping the least benefit from it. And likewise, the poor suffer more from climate change than the countries whose unlimited use of fossil fuels have aided their prosperity. Even the global phenomenon of migration is directly related to the loss of predictable seasons and agricultural cycles, rising tides and depleted seas, the inability to live off traditional lands that have provided for their people for centuries, and increasing war and violence over the scarcity of these resources. Fratelli Tutti builds on all these themes while reflecting on what has been learned, for better or worse, from the pandemic. After an introduction which celebrates the Saint of Assisi for his fraternal love, simplicity, and joy, and as one who connected his love of creation to the love of the human family, especially the poor, the abandoned, the infirm, and the outcast. From the letter of St. Francis that gives the encyclical its title, the Pope pulls out a description of brotherly, fraternal love that transcends the boundaries of geography and distance. And he also shares the 800-year-old story of St. Francis' encounter with the Sultan Malik al-Kamil in Egypt during the time of the Crusades, when Francis dared to approach the Muslim leader unarmed, and the two managed to find common ground as children of the same father. The mutual recognition of their brotherhood was remarkable because it resulted neither in martyrdom nor conversion for either, but mutual respect from each other and for each other. There was no focus on doctrinal differences, but both men allowed themselves to be touched by the love of God revealed by the other. The call of this encyclical is precisely to acknowledge the dignity of each person, which can help in the rebuilding of an aspiration to universal fraternity, something Pope Francis fears had been lost. Thomas Merton's own journey of dialogue with Eastern religions similarly begins with a recognition of a common humanity and a discovery of our basic similarities. Once those are discovered, fear dissipates. Now, who can forget the image of the lonely Pope in a darkened, empty, and rainy St. Peter's Square, with a medieval crucifix from an earlier plague standing nearby and the Eucharistic presence on the altar? It captured the various moods and feelings of the time with all its uncertainty and darkness. Yet it pointed towards a faithfulness to the source of light and life. In retrospect, we might call it an image of the Paschal mystery, from the cross or from the tomb, yet with hope of a resurrection yet to be imagined. Similarly, the encyclical's opening chapter describes darkness, shattered dreams, and setbacks on what had looked like a trajectory toward unification and celebration of diversity in Europe, Latin America, and much of the world. Instead, the Pope notes, the rise of nationalism, ideologies, and a globalism that makes the world more neighbors than brothers and sisters became evident. The Pope is worried about the loss of historical consciousness and the creation of new forms of cultural colonization, like developing nations aspiring to materialist consumption that they could never support. The Pope is even concerned that words like democracy, freedom, justice, and unity have been emptied of their meaning, manipulated by the powerful. The Pope laments a throwaway world and a throwaway people, a declining birth rate, increased wealth with increased inequality, and new, fresh expressions of racism. Every brother or sister in need, he writes, when ignored by the society in which I live, becomes an existential foreigner, even though born in the same country. They may be citizens with full rights, yet they are treated as foreigners in their own country. Racism is a virus that quickly mutates, and instead of disappearing, goes into hiding and lurks in waiting. He describes the state of globalization as a world making progress without a shared roadmap. No idea where we are going. Pope Francis cannot hide his disappointment that there was barely a momentary recognition of the existence of a global community at the outset of the pandemic. It just didn't last. The mysterious virus that brought the whole world to a halt could have been a golden opportunity for a collective response and for transnational cooperation, for healing and the preservation of lives. But instead, we very quickly broke into our own camps and divided ourselves about the source of the virus, whose fault it was, how to resist it, whether it existed at all, and we fought over masks and vaccines, and seemed again and again to prefer individual freedom over the common good. As we faced isolation and loneliness, and sought new ways to connect digitally, even for the celebration of the Eucharist, we did not seem to learn the lesson of our mutual interdependence and our need for each other. Pope Francis says, we ended up consuming distraction, insularity, and solitude. We gorged ourselves on networking and lost the taste of fraternity. We looked for quick and safe results, only to find ourselves overwhelmed by impatience and anxiety. Prisoners of a virtual reality, we lost the taste and flavor of the truly real. He poignantly reminds us of the elderly who died because they had no access to respirators, and the greater impact of inequities in our healthcare systems, even in terms of access to the vaccine. He asks why we can't see the futility of such a divided approach. If only we might rediscover once for all that we need one another, he says, and that in this way our human family can experience a rebirth beyond the walls that we have erected. Unless we recover the shared passion to create a community of belonging and solidarity worthy of our time, our energy, and our resources, the global illusion that misled us will collapse and will leave many in the grip of anguish and emptiness. Here in Kentucky, we might recall that our governor had the right instinct to remind us daily during the pandemic that we're all in this together, even though we soon discovered that we were not together in the same way. Some had the possibility of working remotely, while we created the terminology of essential workers, which meant those who were daily exposed to the virus and rarely received additional compensation. We discovered the racial disparity in care accessibility and how those who struggled with health problems and lack of health care before the pandemic were significantly more vulnerable to devastation by the virus. In the encyclical, the Pope describes the darkness of so-called populism, when that so-called populism is disconnected from the needs and the reality of real people. He describes the new forms of xenophobia and rejection of migrants and the shameless aggression of ideologies. Quote, things that until a few years ago could not be said by anyone without risking the loss of universal respect can now be said with impunity and in the crudest of terms, even by some political figures. Haven't we seen plenty of that in the last month? But of course, the universal shepherd cannot remain mired in the negativity, nor surrounded by the clouds, the dark clouds he so convincingly describes. Pope Francis is first and foremost a minister of the gospel and eager to proclaim the hope that is accessible to all of us. And as Merton could discover in his hermitage or at a busy downtown intersection, God is still at work in all places and times, and God continues to lavishly pour out his love, whether it's received or even acknowledged or not. Pope Francis turns most naturally to the scriptures and tradition in order to read the signs of the times in which God is working here and now. And at the heart of the encyclical is the Pope's fresh reflection on the parable of the Good Samaritan from Luke's Gospel. He notes the timelessness of the underlying problem. What is my responsibility to the other? Am I my brother's keeper? Who must I love and how much? And when the lawyer in the parable poses the question, who is my neighbor, to Jesus, he's looking for a way to circumscribe his responsibility. Now, we recently heard our Catholic vice president suggest that our Christian tradition limits the radius of love that is expected of us, that we are to love those who are nearest to us first because we can't possibly love everyone. Pope Francis promptly responded to this erroneous statement with the same parable. Drawing on the manner of engaging the imagination employed by Ignatius of Loyola, This Jesuit pope describes the scene of the parable in a compelling and tangible way. The Samaritan on the road to Jericho, who becomes the unlikely model of loving righteousness, is an outsider in that place. He's a foreigner with no rights. Yet it is this outsider who steps up when those whose religious status gave them rights and respectability, but they did nothing to help the person beaten up on the road. It is the Samaritan who goes far out of his way, uses his own time and resources to care tenderly for the man in need, and even brings him to an inn for further care. The parable describes the lavish care expended on a wounded stranger. And the Pope asks us to consider who are the people beaten up on the road today, and whether those who would be expected to provide aid are actually doing so. He also mentions the role of the innkeeper as part of the social structure needed for that man's healing, because no good Samaritan can accomplish everything alone. The Samaritan, who basically gives the innkeeper a blank check, might not have even been welcome to stay in that inn as a paying guest himself. Thomas Merton also had an opportunity to reflect on that well-known parable from Luke's Gospel. And while he and the Pope both highlighted the role of the Samaritan, obviously, the historical context in which they're writing are very different and create different expectations on the part of the readers. For Merton, the anti-Semitism that was so evident in the preconciliar church really conditioned the way the parable was received in his reflection from 1962. It was surprising to me that Merton needed to emphasize not only that the Samaritan was a provocative choice for Jesus to use as the hero in its original context, but that Merton presumed his readers would have naturally read the Jewish characters as the obvious bad guys. He felt the need to explain that they would have presumed to be the potential heroes in the original setting. Addressing the reader, Merton says that for us, all Samaritans are good Samaritans because we identify with the Samaritan. And the presumption for the Christian hearer is that the priest and Levite are bad because they're Jews. Then he points out that since the parable addresses the question of loving one's neighbor, neither Jew nor Samaritan is a neighbor in any comforting way. And therein, of course, lies the point. Neighbors are not only those who share something with us or with those whom we are already comfortable. A monk, not a Trappist, who was giving a retreat talk to priests, introduced another dimension to that parable, building on Pope Francis's observation that the Samaritan had no standing or rights in that setting on the road to Jericho. What happens when the person who's not supposed to have power tries to be loving and neighborly to the more powerful? Had the man beaten by robbers not been in such great need, would he have even accepted help from a Samaritan? This monk, with surprising frankness, suggested that he knew for certain that his own grandfather would have rather died from the wounds on the road than to accept loving kindness from a black person in the role of the Samaritan. Entire encyclical, Fratelli Tutti, rejects any kind of society of exclusion. And it seems today that we're trying to rebuild that kind of exclusion. Pope Francis once said that the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," could be translated today as "Thou shalt not exclude," because exclusion leads to death. He expresses disbelief that still there are those who appear to feel encouraged or at least permitted by their faith to support varieties of narrow and violent nationalism, xenophobia and contempt, and even the mistreatment of those who are different. But today, we have a great opportunity to express our innate sense of fraternity, to be good Samaritans who bear the pain of other people's troubles rather than fomenting greater hatred and resentment. After all, Jesus asks us not to decide who's close enough to be our neighbor, but that we become neighbors to all. The rise of so-called Christian nationalism that impacted our last election makes it tragically clear that not everyone sees racism as incompatible with their Christian faith. Following that reflection and its contemporary application, the rest of the encyclical invites the whole world on a journey from being a mob of strangers inhabiting the same planet to finding common ground, and to move from being associates with common interests to becoming neighbors concerned with each other's good, and ideally to becoming brothers and sisters who share a common origin and a common home. To move from the closed world of dark clouds, Pope Francis calls us to imagine and to help create a more open world. A more open world is based on human relationships, like the Good Samaritan, transcend ethnic and national boundaries. The Pope emphasizes that the common good requires a recognition of the great worth of each person. Solidarity must be more than a sporadic generosity. It comes from a conversion to the recognition that each person is of value. And politics in this vision must involve the concept of gratuitousness rather than consist of a merely utilitarian approach to relationships. In other words, a pay-to-play society is not compatible with the gospel vision. Life without fraternal gratuitousness becomes a form of frenetic commerce, the Pope says. Only a social and political culture that readily and gratuitously welcomes others will have a future. And Thomas Merton and other Trappists like Paul Keenan talk about the useless life, the life that is devoted to the non-tangible benefits and blessings. They're talking about that gratuitousness that Francis is describing. Pope Francis' vision for the world today, the gospel vision of the kingdom of God, requires the cultivation of a contemplative stance. Thomas Merton argued for the relevance of contemplation in the midst of the social turmoil of the 1960s. It's not just the occasion of his 100th birthday that moved Francis to include Thomas Merton among the Americans he cited in his address to Congress. It is the relevance of this voice coming from a monastic cloister in the hidden hills that offers the perspective needed for the creation of this more open world. It's not too difficult to imagine where Merton and Pope Francis would find plenty of common ground. Francis has called us to a new appreciation of silence and listening, which opens us to the possibility of dialogue. Attentive listening allows us to grow in esteem and respect for the other by learning what moves in their heart. And although it's not received nearly enough attention in the United States, Pope Francis has invited the whole church to embark on a journey together, a journey of synodality, which is all about discerning a path forward together for a common future. Without learning how to listen to the Holy Spirit and how to listen to one another, we will continue to journey without a roadmap. But our faiths are interconnected. At various moments of my own spiritual journey, I have seen the figure of Thomas Merton beckoning me to take another look at his experiment with the eremitic life and to create more room for contemplation and silence that will make it possible to listen and engage in dialogue. I've been blessed to visit Gethsemane on several occasions and even to have participated in a reflection group that meets in Merton's Hermitage. But it's the title and the content of his journal reflections in Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander that has brought his thought most forcefully home to me. The extended aftermath of the George Floyd killing by police in Minneapolis and the Black Lives Matter movement that arose in its aftermath provided many opportunities, even during the pandemic, to begin to take seriously the systematic racism in our society that many of us would rather ignore. Had we allowed ourselves to continue to challenge a system where some lives could be extinguished with impunity, we could have been well on the way to forming a more open and relational world, as Fratelli Tutti describes. On one occasion, I had been invited to speak at the placement of a plaque acknowledging a lynching that took place at the so-called Singing Bridge in Frankfurt, our state capital. It struck me at that time, when the lynching was actually happening in 1909, there were those who participated in it as spectacle. It was a social event to which people turned out in great numbers and which some would consider a deterrent to crime, although in reality it was a warning against being black in a white society. Some who were not there for the spectacle lived with the fear that they too were vulnerable because of the color of their skin. They knew that they too could easily be singled out as a warning for others, and their hanging become a celebration of the importance of law and order. Some could not bear to watch because they knew and loved the person being hung. But how many were simply bystanders, not relishing in the spectacle, nor questioning the injustice, but contributing complicity by their silence? What would my role have been in that crowd had I been there? And more importantly, what is my role as other forms of lynching and social injustice are rampant in our society and our world? The conjectures of the guilty bystander were not those of someone with moral or material cooperation in carrying out the lynchings and other injustices, but those who benefit from a system in which these injustices go unchallenged, those with the luxury to forget. Are we guilty bystanders still? Lawrence S. Cunningham, Elena Mallets, and others have described Merton's guilt in Conjectures as not so much something he felt for being removed from the struggle by his life in the monastery, he wrestled with that, but by discovering himself as an accomplice in the world's evil. Cunningham says that Merton felt guilt for the comfort of his monastery, for the role of the church's complicity with racial segregation and war, and for being committed to the institution at times more than the message of the institution. But his self-reflection and lifelong critique of the institutions of monasticism and the church itself opened him to a new understanding and appreciation of precisely what he and monasticism did contribute and what an alternative contribution could be. To adopt a life that is essentially non-assertive, non-violent, a life of humility and peace, is in itself a statement of one's position. By my monastic life and vows, I am saying no to all the concentration camps, the aerial bombardments, the staged political trials, the racist injustices, the economic tyranny, and the whole social economic apparatus. I made monastic silence a protest against the lies of politicians, propagandists, and agitators. And when I speak, it is to deny that my faith in my church can ever be sincerely aligned with these forces and injustices. Merton's immersion in the life of contemplation helped him both resist the temptation to constantly react to situations of injustice and allowed him to find a deeper grounding in the Christian tradition as a source for nonconformity or active nonviolent resistance. That deeper grounding allowed Merton to discover similar approaches to this great vision of humanity in other religious traditions. traditions as near to us as Judaism and as remote as the Eastern mystical traditions. Merton can name the individualism that is so much at the heart of our social ills in ways very similar to Pope Francis. In Disputed Questions, Merton says, "Individualism is nothing but the social atomism that has led to our present inertia, passivism, and spiritual decay. Yet it is individualism which has really been the apparent ideal of our Western society in the past 200 or 300 years. This individualism presents our economic concept with a pseudo-spiritual and moral facade, but is in fact mere irresponsibility. It is, and always has been, not an affirmation of human value, but a flight from the obligation from which these values are inseparable, and first of all, a flight from the obligation to love." Merton came to see his monastic vocation as a quest for marginality, according to Cunningham. Since the beginning of his papacy in 2013, Pope Francis has been calling the church to the margins. Excuse me. Has been calling the church to the margins where Christ will be experienced first and foremost in the poor. Merton's understanding of his marginality may well mean being on the far edge rather than the cutting edge of innovation and influence. Pope Francis makes that marginality more explicitly the vast majority of the global poor who are excluded and lack input in the ever smaller decision-making structures with power in the world. To connect with the margins in this way is essential to the church's mission of evangelization. Francis would agree with Merton that the more the church is engaged with the powerful economic structures of the world, the less the prophetic vocation can effectively be practiced. With an elderly Pope Francis hospitalized with pneumonia, and now barely a month into the Trump presidency, a stance of contemplation and a reassertion of the Christian vision seems an absolute necessity. Merton showed us that the contemplative life does not have to be distant from the role of prophetic activism, but it does have to be more reflective than reactive. That's only somewhat encouraging at a time when we can never be sure of what outrage and blatant disregard for justice is coming next. But to understand the contemplative stance is a way of connecting to all of humanity and contributing to that more fraternal world envisioned by Pope Francis. The Pope reminds us that each day offers us a new opportunity, a new possibility. Today we have a great opportunity to express our innate sense of fraternity, to be good Samaritans who bear the pain of other people's troubles rather than fomenting greater hatred and resentment. Like the chance traveler in the parable, we need only have a pure and simple desire to be a people, a community, constant and tireless in the effort to include, integrate, and lift up the fallen. We may often find ourselves succumbing to the mentality of the violent, the blindly ambitious, those who spread mistrust and lies. Others may continue to view politics or the economy as an arena for their own power plays. For our part, let us foster what is good and place ourselves at its service. At the conclusion of his address to the U.S. Congress nearly a decade ago, Francis appealed to the optimism and spirit of the American people and reminded us, "A nation can be considered great when it defends liberty as Lincoln did, when it fosters a culture which enables people to dream of full rights for all their brothers and sisters as Martin Luther King sought to do, when it strives for justice and the cause of the oppressed as Dorothy Day did by her tireless work, the fruit of faith which becomes dialogue and sows peace in the contemplative style of Thomas Merton. May we ever strive for that greatness."